Hello, and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else,
a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country and around the world.
This podcast is produced by faculty and staff in the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana.
And now let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else.
Hi, I'm Jay Todd, Associate Director for the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Belle Whelan, who has, since 2005, served as President of the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, commonly referred to as SACS-COC. She is the first African-American and the first woman to serve in this capacity. Over the past 40 years, Dr. Whelan has worked her way up the academic ladder, beginning as a professor of psychology before serving as a dean, a provost, and a college president. In 2001, after establishing an impressive reputation as president of Northern Virginia Community College, the second largest community college in the nation, she was asked by Governor Mark Warner to serve as Secretary of Education for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Dr. Whelan received her PhD in Educational Administration from the University of Texas, her MA in Developmental Educational Psychology from LSU, her BA from Trinity University with a double major in Psychology and Sociology. She is the recipient of numerous awards, including most recently the John Hope Franklin Award for Outstanding Leadership in Higher Education and the Terry O'Banion Prize in Education from the League for Innovation in Community Colleges. Just to provide a little bit of context to our listeners, Dr. Whelan and I are recording this interview on a beautiful autumn day in Houston, where the attendees for the SACS annual meeting have started to arrive. And it will be, I imagine, if isn't already, a busy weekend for you. So, Dr. Whelan, we really appreciate you taking a few minutes to take some time out of your busy schedule to speak with us today.
It's my pleasure.
I don't want to spend the whole interview specifically on accreditation. I'd like to ultimately talk to you a little bit more about kind of the future of education. But since I do have you here, I thought I would start with a question or ask you to kind of define it in this way. How would you explain the purpose of the accreditation process in higher education to a faculty member who sees anything with the label accreditation on it as busy work?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Accreditation has been around a long time. It's not anything new. Our association has been in business since 1895, so it's old hat for a lot of us. There were three reasons we go through accreditation in the first place. One is to help an institution improve. It's a continuous improvement process. So we come in once every 10 years to see how you're doing. We'll come back 10 years later, say, have you gotten better? We have an interim report in there. And it's just because the second reason for accreditation is to help the public feel good about coming to your institution. You know, there is indeed value. It is an opportunity for people to better their lives, and it's quality work and stuff. And then the third reason, of course, is to have access to federal financial aid in order to be able to pull off the first two. We, because faculty are responsible for instructing students, then they are vital to the accreditation process because we expect them to identify those expectations they have of students as a result of having attended their institution. We call those student learning outcomes. So for every academic program, we ask faculty, tell us what you expect students to be able to do when they leave you with a degree from your institution. Then how do you know that they're doing it? How do you know they've earned those skills? And so we ask them to assess the skill sets, skill levels of the students. And then the third thing is, once you get that data, what kind of changes are you making at the institution to ensure that you are continuing to improve and students are getting better? So that's really why we ask them to do accreditation, because we want to make sure that, you know, there's value added to a student's life as a result of having attended the institution.
All right. Great. Thank you. If I could kind of flip that a little bit, because like I said, this is our primary audience is Xavier faculty, but we hope that a larger kind of audience of people interested in faculty development do listen in. Mm-hmm. Can you describe, you talked about the value that the students get out of the accreditation, and obviously the public could get out of it as well. Is it possible, is there a certain value that maybe the faculty can get out of the accreditation process?
Oh, sure. I think by gathering the data to see at what level their students are performing today, it adds value, because then they can go back and see, well, I didn't quite explain that well enough, or maybe I could find better examples, you know, that would provide opportunities for students to learn better. It also, because the process itself is a peer review process, then you have people from other like institutions coming in to share some best practices with you, to say that that's working, but, you know, here at these other institutions, as we've gone out to visit, we found that here's something else that might also work. So there's a consultative piece that goes in there to help faculty improve, you know, whatever it is that they're teaching.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this next one isn't so much a question, but a statement that I hope you might respond to. Sachs defines learning fairly specifically as a change in students' knowledge, skills, behaviors, or values. These days, many faculty worry about what often gets called the professionalization of education, in which job readiness becomes the sole outcome. And it often seems that the very definition of learning is shifting to focus solely on skills development.
I have this argument all the time with people outside of higher ed, because there is no doubt there is a need to have people who can fill jobs. I mean, that our nation will lose its position of national prominence if we don't continue to have people in a position to be able to move into the jobs of tomorrow. Some of those jobs, unlike when we came out of college, only require minimal skills, you know, not an entire college degree as we know it. Many more of those exist today than ever before. And so because of the way our higher education system is developed or organized, after high school, the only place you have to go to get those skill sets is college, okay? But I tell liberal arts faculty all the time, but students still need to know how to read and write and count and think, you know, critically, and make decisions and value judgments, all of the things of which a traditional liberal arts education requires. And so don't give up on the liberal arts mission just because we've got this major need economically to ensure that our economy stays strong by having people move into the workforce. One way to help that, and I encourage faculty to do it, is to actually talk with faculty in other disciplines. Here's a novel concept, you know, that get out of your silo, and if you're teaching a history course or a philosophy course, go talk with the science faculty and say, how can we work together so that your students understand where this history started, where this science started, where this whatever started, to see the applicability of those kinds of principles in today's world. So that team teaching approach that we learned about 30 years ago that sometimes we still ignore very much is relevant today, because students can see, I may not have to sit in a separate class, but I can, to satisfy those two requirements, I could do a team-taught class, for example, or at least see some relevance between the two processes. So I don't think it's unimaginable, you know, that the teaching profession could change as a result of it. But,
So you see the multidisciplinary or even the interdisciplinary teaching as a direct...
Definitely. And, you know, just because I'm going into chemistry or computer science or plumbing, for that matter, does not mean that I'm not going to have to write a written report so that a client understands, or I'm not going to have to explain, you know, to my customer what I did, or I get into a situation and go, oh my goodness, I didn't realize this was as bad as it was. How do I figure it out? Those skills are still very much necessary. Mm-hmm. And either students take a course in those strategies, or we find ways to include those strategies in those application courses.
Are there ways, you think, to help change the public perception of the need
well,
for...
Well, you know, having to work with employers all the time is certainly important. I mean, they complain, and you know, I get into this with them too. You complain on one hand that, you know, I just want them to learn how to plumb or you know, be a plumber or a computer operator. And then when they get to you, you say, well, but they can't talk and they can't work in teams. You know, it's like, make up your mind. You know, tell us what you really want. And they really do want employees who can think strategies and, you know, and figure out things without a lot of supervision, you know, who can work in teams, who can adequately explain, you know, whatever the process is. They really do want those skills. But they also, you know, see making money, you know, as knowing how to do whatever the specific major area is. But they say, well, yeah, you're right. We want both. I said, then you need to tell us that you want both and admit that you want both, and don't just talk about, you know, somebody having specific skill sets for a specific career. Yeah.
And that kind of leads into I think the primary question I had in mind when I first, you know, kind of asked about this interview. But it's a pretty broad question, but. Where do you really see higher education going? You know, where do you see the American collegiate system kind of, or how do you see it evolving in the next 10 years or so?
Oh, wow. I didn't bring my crystal ball to Houston, so that's going to be a little tough for me. I think that because there is such a my story has always been, number one, we were not prepared for the impact technology was going to have on the workforce. We knew it was going to make some jobs easier. We did not realize it was going to eliminate as many jobs as it did for people who used to be able to hold those jobs and make a good living for their family without a college degree. Those jobs don't exist anymore. Every job that's out there, at least 80% of the jobs out there now, require some kind of training beyond high school. My generation didn't have as many children as my mother's generation, so we don't have as many people coming into college and subsequently into the workforce. So it's imperative that everybody, you know, be skill ready of some sort. And then the largest percentage of people in the workforce are old farts like me who want to get out of the workforce very soon, you know. And so that has caused a bubble that has created panic in this country that we are not going to be able to keep up with our international competitors because, you know, we don't have people ready to go into those jobs. And so because of that fear and that anxiety, then we are trying to find ways to get people trained well enough to go into jobs and then come back later and get a college degree, where historically it's been the other way around. You get the college degree, and then you can go into these jobs. Right. And so when Cisco first came out with, you know, their certifications, you could take levels A, B, C, and D and start working and then get promoted because of that. Well, many more career fields are doing the same thing. So you've got badges that are coming out. You've got competency-based education so that we can get people who already have the skill sets, you know, credit for having that knowledge without having to take a class. So I think we're going to continue to see those kinds of innovations as long as we have, and, you know, they call them disruptions because they didn't come out of higher ed. If we had created them, they would have been innovations. You know, I firmly believe that. So what you've got is a new tapestry for life preparation, with the traditional baccalaureate degree being one option now. But now we've got a slew of options out there that we never had before. And so traditional higher ed is having to find a way to, you know, ensure that it still has students to enroll, you know, while not having as many 18 to 21-year-olds available to them in the first place. So many more adult programs are surfacing. Many more online programs are surfacing because we have to go where the majority of the people are, and the majority of students in higher ed today are over 25 years old. They are not the 18 to 21-year-olds.
And again, kind of the same follow-up before, but what can the kind of the individual faculty member kind of do to kind of prepare for or participate in that?
Well,
that
I mean, I think there are different strategies for teaching adults than there are for your traditional 18 to 21-year-olds. You know, 18-year-olds especially have just come out of high school where they had to ask for a bathroom pass. You know, and now we expect them to be all grown, and now you've got 25-year-olds who are indeed grown. Mm. They have life experiences that they're bringing with them. So spending the same kind of time imparting knowledge is different. The access of the internet and Google and everything else being out there. I started as a faculty member 42 years ago. I was four when I started. But nonetheless, we had to share more basic knowledge because it was too difficult to get to it, you know, in a quick manner. Now with the internet, people can hit a button and find out terms and explanations and things. We're much more into the application of that knowledge and have the expectation that students will take more of a lead in finding out that basic knowledge on their own. So faculty's role has changed from the sage on the stage, as we called it, to now the facilitator of learning. Okay, you all had, you know, were able to garner this information, so what? What do we do with it? That's the role of the faculty more and more, I think, upcoming.
Okay. Yeah. So when we hear terms like, you know, the flipped classroom or problem-based learning, all those kind of often kind of hot terms,
yes,
are...
I think they're real. I think because students are older coming in, they're bringing a body of knowledge with them that 18-year-olds, you know, typically don't have because of the access to information through the internet. Faculty don't have to spend as much time giving that basic information. Now they have to focus on, now that you have that information, how do you use it? And that's why employers are saying, you know, you help me get people who, you know, have that knowledge, because you really don't have to and you know, spend as much time. Competency-based education, where you don't have to go to class anymore. If you can demonstrate that you've got the competency, we'll give you the college credit for it. You know, competency-based education has been around for a very long time, but not to the extent that you can get an entire college degree, you know, like it is today. So I think all of those forces have converged upon each other, and it does impact teaching faculty without a doubt. And it's much more responsibility of the so what question rather than the, you know, information sharing question.
Well, as someone who teaches freshman composition, the so what question is always important to me.
Sure.
Do you think all of that applies kind of across the board, even to say minority institutions,
HBCUs without a doubt. The challenge that many HBCUs have are that the students who are coming to them oftentimes are not as well prepared academically. They're not as well read. They have not had access to the internet. Public school or the K-12 systems, whether it's public or private education, from which they're coming, have not prepared them as well, you know, or they just didn't pay attention while they were there. I mean, pick a reason. And so there's still a great deal of basic information sharing or the development of skills to teach them how to go find that information that institutions with other selective admission, and you've got students who are accustomed to being that old traditional student, you know, would have. And so I think that the challenges are greater because you've got to help develop skill sets and study skills and, you know, library searches that students just did not bring with them, whether they didn't pay attention to it when they were coming through, you know, whether it's been so long since they had to do anything with them, you know, then you've got to teach them all over again. So you've got that extra student support that's necessary for students who are coming into many of our HBCUs. But I think that the same principle applies. Once you can get them oriented to performing in college, then you've got the so what question to ask. You still have the opportunity and the responsibility, I think, to hold them responsible for seeking out some of their own knowledge so that when they come to class, then they will be able to respond to the faculty members' so what question, you know, or the applicability of the knowledge that they've acquired.
Sure. One often kind of criticism, this kind of brings it a little bit back to accreditation, but is that the accreditation system can make people fearful of innovation because the fear that if we innovate, then we're going to be in violation of
and
something like that.
You know, I don't know where that paranoia surfaced. I really don't, because, I mean, all we ask is if you're going to do something differently, let us know what it is that you plan to do. And I can understand there are many hoops through which you must jump if this is so brand new, nobody's ever heard of it before. But I don't know of any innovative idea that has come to us that we've turned down. So I don't know where the fear that we can't do something different. I mean, our own standards, we used to have over 400 criteria that were extremely rigid and extremely prescriptive. And in 2002, 13 years ago, we changed that to now here are the basic principles. You tell us how you meet them. So we've gone from being extremely prescriptive to being extremely non-prescriptive. And, I mean, it leaves open all kinds of doors for innovation. So it boggles my mind every time I hear somebody say, well, we can't be innovative because, I mean, you know, when distance learning came in, we had standards that we developed to make it easier for institutions to do. Of course, we had to work through some of that stuff. If it's new, then we have to look at all angles. But we don't stop innovation. You know, it may not happen automatically, but this is higher ed. Nothing happens automatically.
And two things that are kind of going on or kind of topics of conversation at Xavier are interdisciplinarity. And then in the faculty development in the CAT Plus office, we're focusing a lot on the flipped classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those, I guess, would you say just require us to maybe explain when we've got two people in the classroom or when we're putting all the content learning in the flipped classroom outside and kind of shifting the balance of what contact hours? Ultimately, we just need to...
all of higher ed is based traditionally on 3-semester-hour mm-hmm. courses. If you do anything differently, we just need to understand it, okay? So if you've got two faculty members who are teaching in the same course, we want to be assured that both of them are qualified to teach mm-hmm. whatever it is that they're teaching. That's never changed, whether it's there's one person in a class or five people teaching the class. We just need to know that they're qualified, okay? We used to say that they had to have a master's degree and 18 graduate hours mm-hmm. in what they were teaching. We got rid of that requirement in 2002, 13 years ago, though you wouldn't know it by some of my institutions because they're in shock when I tell them that. Some institutions have chosen to retain that requirement, but that's not what we say. You tell us why you think this person is qualified to teach this particular course. And it could be certificates they've earned. It could be awards they've received. It could be outstanding evaluations that they've gotten over 15 years. I mean, it could be a lot of things. So there's a lot of gray in what we do compared to all the black-white that we used to have, you know, in the process. But our goal is never to say no. Our goal is to say, you explain it to me, and as long as it makes sense for a collegiate-level course, you know, then you'll get no arguments from me.
Great. Thank you. That's good to hear. I've taken up... I think a good chunk of your time, and I promise not to take up too much. But we talked a little bit about the future of education, and you talked about kind of the changes in the demographics.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're in obviously a very kind of lengthy election cycle. part of that is a very kind of populist push for obviously dealing with the cost, the ever-increasing cost of education. Hillary Clinton has put out a plan to help address that. Bernie Sanders has kind of taken a much more aggressive approach and called for completely free public education. In the American collegiate system, we've had kind of a couple of times, at least two times, where the system has radically changed because the kind of people who were able to attend school changed fairly mm-hmm. radically. Do you see a push like that for maybe ultimately, like Bernie Sanders says, free public education?
I think it would be wonderful if we could have free education for all. I don't think it's very realistic given the fact that we have legislators at both the state and national level who won't raise taxes, and I don't know from where they think they're going to get the revenue to create free college tuition across the board. But yeah, I think it would be magnificent if we could do that. There are other countries whose students are outperforming us in a lot of ways, and they do have free education. I think the Tennessee Promise is showing that it's a great idea, but they haven't seen that many new people come into the system as a result of it. And so I don't know what impact it's going to have. I think it's a start to talk about the first 2 years of college being free. You know, again, because of this strong need for people to go into the workforce, the original proposal was for first 2 years of community colleges to be free. Plus, community college tuition is less expensive than any other part of higher education, so that made good sense. Let's invest where we can get more bang for our buck, as it were. But I don't. If we're going to do it, why not give the first 2 years free for all kinds of college tuition? If your goal is to get more educated folks, you know, and finances is a part of that, especially from adults who have families and who have jobs and who can't go away to college, for example, but who'd like to take advantage of distance programs, you know, and they cost money, then yeah, let's do that for everybody who wants to come in for that first 2 years.
Great. Well, do you have any kind of final thoughts just on where education's going or something you'd like to kind of leave the...
I'm on Lumina's board, and Lumina has been leading the charge with Goal 2025 of 60% of Americans 18 to 64, you know, having some kind of credential by 2025, and we're very slow in meeting that goal. I think the more educated a citizenry is, then the more tolerance we have, the more acceptance we have, you know, of people, because there's a better understanding, the more greater chances of world peace. I mean, it sounds hokey, but the reality is, you know, when we start helping people understand differences rather than fearing them and therefore hating them because we don't understand them, you know, then I think the world becomes a better place. And it is faculty who do that. Irrespective of the mission of the college, it is still faculty, you know, who share that knowledge, impart that knowledge, explain that knowledge, you know, so that people do have a better understanding and are different people than they were when they entered that environment. So I miss being a faculty member. It is that aha moment when you can see students of any age or color or creed or either gender, you know, you can say, oh, that's what you mean. I mean, that's what faculty do. And I applaud all your faculty who have taken up that mantle and wish them nothing but success in it.
Oh, well, thank you. Like I said at the beginning, it's the change that is critical. Right. Yep. Well, Dr. Whelan, I know you, like I said, you have a lot going on over the next few days, so I really do thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Anytime. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Dr. Bell Whelan, the president of SACS COC, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges. For links to some of the things mentioned today and resources about accreditation and assessment, please visit our website at cat.zula.edu and click on podcast at the bottom of the menu. I'm Jay Todd, Associate Director for the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else.
For more information, please visit our website at cat.zula.edu.
That's C-A-T dot X-U-L-A dot E-D-U.
Until next time, keep on teaching, learning, and everything else.